We have no choice but to farm our lands. I am not educated, and in this country, even qualified people don't get jobs.
India farmers remain united. It's Thursday, March 4th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, discrimination against Chinese Australians, a big Thailand drug bust, Asia drugs still devastate, amplifying hearing loss, tiny Thai restaurants. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Farmers in North India have led a three-month-long protest against three agricultural laws that aim to reform India's farm sector, but which they fear will impact their livelihoods. Anjana Pasricha visited a village in Haryana state to talk to farmers about why they are standing firm on their demand that the laws must be repealed.
Rampal grew up watching his village transform as high-yielding varieties of wheat and rice brought prosperity to the countryside in North India. It was called India's Green Revolution, but times have changed.
Over the last 10 to 20 years, our profits have been dwindling steadily. That is because all costs of inputs into farming has increased, whether it is diesel, petrol, fertilizer, or seeds.
This massive farmers' protest along Delhi's highways against three new farm laws is now in its fourth month. It draws its sustenance from deepening discontent in villages like Dariapur. Bhagwan Dahiya's livelihood has become more precarious. High-yielding varieties have depleted soil nutrition and water tables. Extreme weather events that can ruin crops have become more frequent. Dahiya feels his labor does not fetch adequate returns, but he does not know what else to do.
We have no choice but to farm our lands. I am not educated, and in this country, even qualified people don't get jobs. Who will give me one? And how can I move to another area of work when I am 45 years old?
The disillusionment is echoed by others who mostly own small farms of less than 2 hectares.
Young people like me want to leave farming. We slog the whole day in the fields and there is such little profit.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi has repeatedly assured farmers that the new laws will improve rural incomes and encourage private investment in the agricultural sector. But these villagers echo fears voiced at protest sites of being exposed to market forces at a time when they already face rising uncertainties.
The farmers here are not so educated that they will be able to negotiate with private players. They feel scared of being cheated. In the current system, at least they get paid.
Some walk to protest sites. Others travel in tractors to join the rallying cry of farmers, legalizing a decades-old practice of price guarantees set by the government for 23 crops.
MSP pe legal guarantee ho.
There must be a law to offer minimum prices. Private players will not give us a good price without a legal guarantee.
As farmers browse the newspaper for latest news of the protest, this countryside vows to support the campaign till the laws are scrapped, however long it takes. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Dariapur, Haryana, North India.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Twitter at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And of course, you can find us at our website, voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Myanmar security forces take aim at anti-coup protesters. 6 journalists covering Myanmar unrest arrested. Cambodia deports Chinese journalists over vaccine for sale story. Pakistan, Iran, Turkey cargo train service to resume this week. North India farmers determined to keep fighting however long it takes against new laws. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you make a visit to Facebook at VOA Asia and join us at our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. According to a new survey, 1 in 5 Chinese Australians say they have been physically threatened or attacked because of their heritage in the past year. Respondents to the study by the Sydney-based Lowy Institute have blamed discrimination on the coronavirus, which was first detected in China, and a growing political rift between Beijing and Canberra. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The survey by the Lowy Institute indicates that a large majority of the Chinese community believe Australia is a good place to live, and most feel a sense of belonging. However, 18% of respondents said they've been intimidated or physically assaulted because of the pandemic and rising diplomatic tensions. About a third said they'd been verbally abused in the past year. Jennifer Su is a research fellow in the Public Opinion and Foreign Policy program at the Lowy Institute.
People did indicate that COVID-19 and Australia-China relations were the top two factors that affected their experiences of discrimination.
Su told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that despite the abuse, many Chinese Australians felt satisfied with their lives in Australia.
People have this sense of belonging despite the discrimination expressed, and they feel a sense of attachment to Australia. That says something about the strength of Australian society and Australia's multiculturalism.
Last year, China warned of a surge in racism in Australia, fueled by the novel coronavirus. Canberra's call for an inquiry into the origins of the virus was interpreted in Beijing as criticism of its handling of the crisis. Tensions have also been inflamed over allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic politics and cyber espionage. Disagreements over broader geopolitical flashpoints have also been a source of antagonism, including Beijing's contentious territorial claims in the South China Sea, human rights, and Hong Kong's fragile democracy. China is Australia's biggest trading partner, but as the bilateral relationship frays, authorities in Beijing have imposed a range of economic sanctions and restrictions on a range of Australian goods, including barley, coal and wine. Chinese immigration into Australia dates back to the 1800s. More than 1.2 million people of Chinese heritage currently live in Australia. Half migrated from China and 10% were born in Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, another day of demonstrations against military's military junta ended with more fatalities among protesters. Reuters reports at least 2 people were killed in Myanmar's second largest city of Mandalay, with at least 1 person killed in the main city of Yangon. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. Last month's arrest of one of Asia's most wanted men may have dented Southeast Asia's multi-billion dollar drug trade. But with major money to be made, the cartel's main product, methamphetamine, keeps flowing. And Thailand is on the front line to stem that flow. For VOA, Vitra Dwangdi reports from Bangkok.
Highly addictive and cheaper than ever. Record amounts of methamphetamine are pouring out of the drug labs of the Golden Triangle, which straddles the borders of Laos, Myanmar, and Thailand. Asia's drug lords make up to $70 billion a year trafficking their illicit cargo. Thailand is a gateway to the biggest drug markets of Australia and Japan. Thai police are making record seizures, especially of the highly addictive crystal meth. Unlike their Latin American peers, Asia's drug barons shun the limelight. But in January, Dutch police arrested Suchilop in Amsterdam. He is dubbed Asia's El Chapo after the Mexican drug lord. Officials hope Suchilop's capture will break open the secrets of a trade dominated by a shadowy syndicate known as Samgor, or the company.
Samgor is really likely the largest group that engineered the shift we've seen underway in the drug trade in East and Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, over the past half dozen, seven, 8 years, where there's been this massive surge of crystal meth hitting the region. Behind that surge was very tight, well-controlled organization that functioned in a way that we hadn't seen before, essentially as a business network, bringing together different skill sets.
SAMGUR's number two, Lee Chun-chuk, seen here in police photos taken over 3 decades, was arrested in Bangkok 3 months before his boss. He is fighting extradition to Australia on drugs charges.
When gang leaders Lee Chun-chuk and Su Chi-lop were arrested, there was a level of disruption to the transport of large shipments of drugs to Australia, but it will only be temporary. The characteristics of the drug trade are that when the heads are cut off, there'll always be someone rising to the top spot.
For Thailand's drug police, that means the work never stops. But the syndicates also adapt fast, churning out meth, splitting profits with international gangs, and laundering cash through casinos, condos, and cryptocurrency.
Sam Gore's difference is it's almost like a disruptive business model. They, in a sense, worked across groups, networking together different groups with the same common interest of making a lot of money. So they brought together all those different skills and interests.
Thailand counts the human cost of the drug trade in addiction and crime. Akarase Chowain Shinawong, a former crystal meth addict who runs therapy sessions in Bangkok, says oversupply is driving down street prices.
In the past, ice was used by people with money, higher social status. Now, due to its cheap price, it's reaching the middle class and below.
Akarase's addiction robbed him of a happy life. After rebuilding his health, he has a stark warning for those toying with trying the drug.
If you haven't done it, that's a gift from God. Cherish it.
Wichitra Dungdi for VOA News, Bangkok.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia, Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga says the government is considering a 2-week extension of a state of emergency in the Tokyo area due to pressure on the medical system from COVID-19 cases. You'll find this and many more stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. The consumption of fentanyl-laced drugs, many traced to China, is on the rise, and so are the deadly overdoses in the United States. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias sheds light on an epidemic that the pandemic has shoved into the shadows.
My husband just passed, so it's kind of still, I'm still trying to get through losing him in daily life.
An overdose took the life of Victoria St. Arnold's husband. For decades, he had used prescription drugs and opioids to ease the throbbing pain from a series of spine surgeries.
I'm assuming he thought that he had just gotten some normal pills. It turned out that it was actually fentanyl.
100 times more potent than morphine, the synthetic opioid fentanyl has expanded its deadly presence in the United States. Just a couple milligrams of fentanyl, like a few flecks of salt, can kill. But mixed with heroin and methamphetamine, it's a huge profit maker for illegal drug dealers who sell it without the user's knowledge.
Because fentanyl is going to make people more addicted to those drugs, and it's cheaper, it's potent, it's more stronger. We're seeing a lot more drug overdoses as a result.
In the 12 months ending last July, more than 86,000 people had died of an overdose in the United States, officials estimate. That is up 24.2%. And in the nation's capital, a shocking 60% increase in overdose deaths in 2020. Psychiatrist Dr. Nora Volkov says the COVID-19 pandemic has made things worse.
Stress is the strongest predictor about whether people are going to take drugs. And what is stressful? The social isolation that we live on, the loss of jobs, the downturn of the economy. It is easy to fall into behaviors that temporarily make you feel better.
Corey Cusimano lost her son to an overdose in 2015. She runs a grief group, social distancing required. She says families can't always afford the medication to reverse an opioid overdose or pay for long-term drug treatment.
Rehab is very expensive. It's anywhere from $6,000 to $14,000 for a 30-day inpatient program. And then after that, they can go into sober living, but they're almost kind of left floundering after that, and there's not that same level of support there.
Now, with the risk of spreading the coronavirus, it's more difficult for people with addiction to get help, especially the poor.
The human factor has been taken out because now people have to use mechanical devices, virtual platforms, in an effort to connect with services. Oftentimes, they don't have sufficient internet access and even sometimes the knowledge of how to do that. So it's become very impersonal in a genre that requires human touch and human contact.
In a statement to VOA, the White House says the Biden administration is working on solutions based on science and evidence to expand the addiction workforce and fixing racial disparities in drug policy. Also, drug enforcement agencies are scaling up their prevention campaigns and community outreach.
Starting with school-age children, if they learn early on all the risks associated with these potent lethal substances, that's going to cut off the demand for these substances. It's about prevention, it's about treatment, and it's about enforcement.
It's also about mental health, says Victoria St. Arnold. Families that risk losing a loved one to drugs need to be tough but compassionate and to take care of themselves as well.
Often they really hate themselves because they know how much they're hurting the people around them. I think they need to know that they're loved, but you still have to be firm. You can't just allow certain behaviors because it's harmful to everybody.
Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
Making headlines in Asia, the first batch of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine arrived in Taiwan. Taiwan has signed contracts securing 10 million doses of the vaccine, more than 5 million doses of the Moderna vaccine, and an additional 4.76 million doses of vaccine through COVAX. Stay up to date. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, we may take hearing for granted as we listen to this program together. There's an epidemic of hearing loss, and it currently affects 1.5 billion people globally. It's World Hearing Day, and the World Health Organization is marking the day by setting out a roadmap for action contained in the WHO's first World Report on Hearing. Lisa Schlein tells us more for VOA from Geneva.
WHO officials warn nearly 2.5 billion people will be living with some degree of hearing loss by 2050 if nothing is done to prevent or mitigate this condition. Nearly a third, they say, will require hearing rehabilitation. The personal and economic cost of this condition is huge. Many people who are deaf or suffer from varying degrees of hearing loss are stigmatized and spend much of their lives in isolation. Additionally, WHO reports unaddressed hearing loss costs the global economy nearly $1 trillion each year. WHO Technical Officer on Ear and Hearing Care, Shelley Chadha, says much of this hearing loss can be prevented.
Many of the causes, for example, hearing loss, which is caused by listening to loud music over one's headphones and earphones, this can be prevented, as can be hearing loss, which is caused by loud noise in one's workplace. Other common causes of hearing loss, ear infections, rubella, meningitis, these are causes which can be prevented by established public health strategies.
Chadha notes almost 60% of hearing loss in children is due to avoidable causes such as ear infections and birth complications. She says solutions are available. She says hearing technologies such as hearing aids and cochlear implants accompanied by rehabilitative therapy can mitigate the adverse effects of hearing loss.
Millions of people across the world are already benefiting from these interventions, but they are a bit of an exclusive group because what we estimate is that across the world, only about 17% of people who need these services actually are able to benefit from them.
People in low-income countries are the most underserved because they lack the specialists, audiologists, and speech therapists who can provide the care required. WHO says this gap can be closed by integrating ear and hearing care into national primary health care services. WHO calls this a great investment, noting for every dollar invested in hearing loss care, governments can expect a return of nearly $16. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo recently reopened restaurants at 25% capacity, easing coronavirus restrictions. That's good news for the city, but it's affecting some small Thai restaurants, as VOA's Janine Poktitam has found in New York.
For the first time in nearly 2 months, restaurants like Jiao Han, a Thai-style hot pot joint in Queens, are allowed to seat diners. It's a first step to ease out of coronavirus restrictions, one familiar to owners of tiny ethnic restaurants and their customers nationwide.
I'm ecstatic to reopen my restaurant, and many of my employees are as well. We're hopeful that our customers would still remember us because we had to shut down the business for quite some time.
Jiao Han, it's just one of the 92% of eateries that could not pay full rent in December, according to a new survey by the New York City Hospitality Alliance. The restaurant, like many in New York, still needs a lifeline. The landlord reduced the rent by half. That helped, but the Jiao Han specialty, paper-thin slices of meat and vegetables cooked at the table by diners dipping them in boiling broth, doesn't really work as takeout.
I used the money from the payment protection plan to bring my staff back on payroll. I tried everything to keep my business going, from offering takeout to giving discounts on delivery orders, but it didn't work. No one wanted to eat hot pot at home.
Jiao Han opted out of serving hot pot outdoors due to safety concerns in a neighborhood known for its bustling pedestrian and traffic. So when the restaurant opened this week, fans returned.
This is like my go-to after a hard day at work, so it's been kind of hard to like unwind without it.
I'm happy to be back inside. Dining outdoors in the streets during the winter makes it difficult to enjoy the food and ambience.
But even as customers return, Jiao Han says there still struggles because restaurants can only seat 25% of their capacity at a time.
Some customers have asked if we take reservations, but I have to tell them that I can only service a few people at a given time. I wish the state would allow me to open up more than 25% of the seating capacity. I've taken a loss of revenue because of that.
But it's a start as the number of COVID-19 cases falls and more people get vaccinated. Sudara is hopeful that her hot pot hotspot will soon enjoy a profitable new normal. Janine Pakpitam, VOA News, New York.
That's our program for today. Thanks for joining us at VOA Asia. We continue online at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to have you stop by on any of those platforms. We also thank our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.